Good morning and welcome to the International Connection. This is show number 31 in a series on mind control. And today we're going to hear part two of an interview with Blanche Shavousty, a survivor of U.S. government mind control experiments. Blanche is the U.S. coordinator of the Advocacy Committee for Human Experimentation Survivors of Mind Control, who are currently engaged in a campaign to urge the U.S. government to open an investigation into the mind control experiments. In this interview, Blanche alleges that she was experimented on and harassed involving brain implants, remote electromagnetic imaging, subliminal control, and hypnosis at such sites as Cornell Medical Center in New York, Hollywood Hospital in Vancouver, Syracuse University, Princeton's Parapsychology Lab, and Penn State, which all have been documented to be sites involved in the CIA mind control experiments. You're listening to CKLN 88.1.
Many of the things that happened to me, when they happened, seemed like coincidence. Often they involve seeing things. And now I know, as I told you just a little earlier in this interview, that I have this implant on the underside of my optic nerve, which is why I could see things. And then they would come to pass. I would see something in my mind, and then I would later see it in reality, and I would think there must be some great significance to this. It must be on my path. It's like something I'm supposed to do. I would try to explain it to myself that way.
Now, in the early 70s, you had some involvement with a dream laboratory. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I can. When I first came to New York, I was invited by somebody that I can't remember who, but who, I think it was someone that was in like a pottery class with me, said, hey, we can go over to the Dream Lab and they'll show us a movie about their work and they'll be glad to have us over there, and it's so interesting. So I went. That was when that was the first time I went. I think it must have been 1971. And I remember that we did see a movie, and I can't remember whatever else happened there that day. Then later, maybe 1973 or 74, a person asked me to go to that lab and to take a student there, and I was at the time the head of a guidance department in a public school system, and someone asked me to go and take a student there and to take my daughter also. So I did. And that time when I was there, the second time I was there, we were invited to participate in experiments in an informal way, just stuff that was set up there. And when I tried one of the experiments, which was a psychokinesis experiment that involved influencing the direction that pellets would roll after they went down a chute, I was told that I scored the highest score that had ever been attained on that particular piece of equipment. And I was invited to come back and participate in a formal experiment. So I did. I went back, and the formal experiment involved being put into a isolation room that had very thick walls, and in that isolation room I was put into a chair. I think it was like a reclining chair like a dentist might use now, and all over my body they placed electrodes, and over my eyes they placed what might be described as golf ping pong balls cut in half, and maybe they actually were that. And the room was dark, and they turned a red light on so that with those ping pong balls on my eyes, I could just see a red background. And I had a headset on that played white sound in the form of waves. It sounded like the ocean. And the task I was given was to make the waves increase in speed by relaxing to deeper and deeper levels. It was biofeedback is what it was. And the person who came to the lab with me was put in another room, and a subliminal flash of a painting was shown to her. At least this is what they said. I don't know exactly what was going on, but this is what I was told. And I was supposed to try to see that painting, which they had shown her only a subliminal flash of, and I was to say out loud all the images that came into my mind. So I started relaxing, and I did start having images pop into my mind, and I would say them aloud, and they were, I think they were taping it. And after the experiment was over, they showed me the drawing, the painting, and I had been right on target. They said I scored a direct hit. I had named, you know, most of the things that were in the painting, and that was pretty interesting and exciting to me.
And you corroborated this with your friend who was shown the flash of this painting in the other room?
No, she didn't see it. How I knew that I had scored a direct hit, in addition to their telling me, was that they brought the painting to me, and it was a famous painting. Well, it was by a famous painter anyway. I don't think I had ever seen it before. But it was seven men, I believe, in building a ship, and one of them was holding a pipe, and behind them was a certain design that looked like a seven. And superimposed on the painting, they had drawn two things, which I was able to see. And one of those things they drew was like a little gremlin type that looked sort of like a the shape of a laboratory flask, you know, with a long, long neck and a round body. And another thing that they drew was a human ear. So this is like a regular painting that they have a copy of, and on top of it, they've drawn two more things. And the things that they drew, I saw just as I saw the painting, just as clearly as I saw the painting. And it was funny because the ear looked like a seashell to me, but I said, you know, that's looks like a seashell, but there's something wrong because I know there's supposed to be two of them. It was like somehow my unconscious mind made it into a little joke. I knew there was something wrong calling it a seashell, and it was a human ear. So I was able to do the experiment there, and then afterwards, this is what I mean about one thing sets you up for another. Afterwards, some people that ran a center in New York said to me, well, since you're able to do that now, since you scored a direct hit, why don't you teach a course in testing your psychic ability? So, oh yeah, I said, okay. And so the next thing I knew, I was teaching a course in that center on testing yourself for psychic ability. And then the next thing after that, somebody came from one of the major television networks and made a video of me teaching this course. And then the school where I was employed asked me to run some workshops related to it there. So one thing always led to another. But
now, what do you think, looking back, actually happened there in those dream research lab experiments? Do you think that they were actually measuring your telepathic abilities?
No. I think that this was the development of what people are calling synthetic telepathy now. That I was one of the people that they were developing the technology on, and that I thought that the reason that it was working, you know, that I could see things, was because I was telepathic. But actually, it was probably electromagnetic fields.
So some kind of signaling with electromagnetic equipment that would...
I mean, I did see things exactly as they were drawn.
So you felt that they were putting these images in with the equipment that they had?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then when I did the workshops afterwards in different places, again, I was successful, and many people in the audience were successful. And I believe that the same thing was going on there, that electromagnetic fields were being generated and received.
Now, I wonder if we can talk about what your experiences were at the hypnotherapy center and the particular doctor that was involved in directing that research.
Well, that person is still directing that center. That's a Morton Prince Center, just as I told you there were some Morton Prince Centers since the time Morton Prince and Esterbrook started one at Harvard. and this is another. And I worked there as a freelance agent, more or less. I guess that's what you'd call. I wasn't, at that time I was working as an, I was working independently, and I saw clients privately, but I worked there several days a week. And as far as anything really strange happening there, I can't tell you that anything did, but many strange things happened in my life during the time that I worked there. Relationships that I had, it seems that I went places that I ordinarily wouldn't have. I think that things happened related to that center, but I can't prove it, you see. The person who runs the center is Milton Klein. He did run it then, anyway, and his work was reported by John Marks in his book about the search for the Manchurian candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quoted as saying that he could create a patsy in 3 months and an assassin in 6. So I think that some of... And he was also mentioned as a person who was an advisor to the CIA on the construction of Manchurian candidates. So I think that this work has continued in these Morton Prince centers probably from the beginning, which is maybe why they were set up.
And what was your involvement with Milton Klein, was his name?
Oh, well, he ran the center, and I worked there. I was mm-hmm. a psychotherapist, and I was employed there.
And how long were you at this hypnotherapy center for?
I worked there at least a couple years, and I was a student there for a year before that.
And then what happened in your life after leaving there?
After I left there, I took another job. While I was working there, I was independent. I had a private office in Manhattan, and I worked in their center a couple days, 3 days a week. And after that, I took a full-time job in a private school. And in that job, I was very much influenced by. Well, actually, I was set up to take that job. I was given the advertisement from the newspaper by someone who said, wouldn't this be a good job for you? And I left that advertisement on my desk for quite a few weeks before I finally applied for the job. And when I went to the job interview, I realized that this wasn't a very good job for me. This wouldn't be a good job for me. And I called the director and told her that I wished to drop out of the interview process. And then someone from the school called me and said, oh, no, you can't drop out. You're the one that the teachers really want. Please, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess I was flattered by this, and I said, okay, I'll stay in the running. And I did get the job. And once I was in the job, everything in my life there was manipulated. And
sorry, what was this job?
I was the head of a school, head of a private school.
Uh-huh.
It was a school that had a lower school, a middle school, and an upper school, and I was head of the middle school. But I was manipulated into the job. And then later, about 6 months before I was kidnapped, the same person that called me and said, oh, no, you have to take this job. You're the one that we really want. And I hadn't seen her for years. She came to my office and said that she wanted to be have a few therapy sessions with me. So I saw her. And during these few sessions that I saw her, we talked, and she influenced me to go to be familiar and to be inclined towards going to see a doctor who had been a psychiatrist but who became a nutritionist. And I'm very into nutrition, and so I was influenced. And I thought maybe I will go see her and see if she wants to employ me, because she hires people that do therapy and hypnosis to work with some of her clients. Anyway, when I got out of the hospital, I called her. When I got out of the hospital, she was on, this particular doctor was on my mind, and I called her and I went to her, and about the second or third time that I went to see her, I realized that this record that she's keeping is wrong. She's written here that she's seeing me and she's treating me for parasites that I got in the Orient. That's what she wrote in my record. Well, this was really strange because I had never been to the Orient and she had never tested me for parasites. In fact, no one had ever tested me at that point for parasites. So I see that she's keeping a false record on me. But I didn't actually see her every time I went to the office. She's very busy. I'd see, you know, different people that helped in her office, nurses or different kinds of health practitioners. So I didn't get to see her, and I didn't say anything to anybody about the record being wrong. But the next time I went to her office, I read my record again, and now there is a false report in there, a totally false psychological evaluation that says this is a person who would never go for therapy because of her personality, and this is a person who has a dull mind, and I can't remember all the things that it said, but there were things that just weren't true. And so now I say, well, gosh, she's got a false record of what's ailing me, and now she's got a false report of my mental health. And then the third time I looked in my report, which my folder at her office, was a few weeks later, and now she has a false report from the hospital. The hospital has sent a summary of my stay, and it's false. It says, among other things, that I refused psychological testing while I was in the hospital. I did not refuse psychological testing. I begged them, every one of them, to please give me a psychiatric workup, and I did, in fact, take a psychological test called an MMPI. So she now has a report in her file on me that says I refused psychological testing when I was in the hospital. She has a false psychological report on me, and she has a false record of what's ailing me. So I think, well, I better go copy all this. So I go out of her office with my folder. Oh, when you go to see her, you have a long day there. So, you know, you might have a two-hour wait between seeing one practitioner and the next. So I had like a two-hour or two-and-a-half-hour wait, so I thought, well, I'll just go copy this information at the corner, and I did. I went out of her office. I went down the street. I was waiting for the light. I looked at the man next to me, and I said, you know where there's a copy machine around here? And this guy, he pretends that he doesn't speak English. So he didn't answer me, and I went across the street into the store on the corner, and I asked the girls in there if they knew where there was a copy machine, and they told me. Go down the street to the Hallmark store, and I went there and I started copying this stuff, and in comes the guy that I just saw on the corner and had asked if he knew where there was a copy machine, and he's following me, and now he stands there and he's watching me copy this stuff, and then two more people come in and stand at the copy machine. Meanwhile, the store was empty when I went in there except for the clerk. Now there are four of us, me and three people watching me standing around the copy machine. So I had, as I told you, I had been followed a lot. I had been stalked. I had been harassed. And I knew that that's what was happening now when I was making these copies. So I copied it. And instead of going back directly to the office, which was my intention, actually when I first saw the record, I started writing in it. I started writing, no, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. And I would put my initials by the things as I wrote them. But eventually, after a page of this, I realized this whole thing is wrong and it must be intentional, and then I ran out of the office to copy it. And I made the copies, and I, instead of going back to the office, went home and put the copies in my house. And when I came back to the office, one of the people that worked there met me at the elevator and said, we've been waiting for you. And I said, well, you know, here I am. And I went in and started having an exam. One of the nurses was doing an exam with me, and while she was doing it, another person came in and took the folder that the file was in. It was my personal folder. And I had written on it, I had written that this isn't true and this isn't true and this is a mistake. And I had signed my name. I wanted her to know that something was wrong. But after my little exam there, I came out of that office, and the director of the office said to me, the doctor wants to see you. Okay. So I waited for her, and when I went into her office, she, as soon as I came in her office, she closed the door, and she leaned against the door, and she looked at me, and she said, what did you steal? And I said, I didn't steal anything. What are you talking about? And she said, one of the girls said that you stole something. And I said, well, what did she say I stole? I mean, and when did she think that I stole it? I've been with somebody every minute that I've been in this office today. And I said, I took my folder, but I want you to know that it's wrong, and I wrote on it. You can see that I didn't steal it. It wasn't my intention to keep it. And so she said, well, let me look in your purse. I need to look in your purse. And I didn't want her to look in my purse, but I didn't feel that I could say no. So I said, okay, look in my purse. So she looked in my purse. There was nothing really in there except a change purse and a comb. So she was satisfied then. But what she was really doing, I think, she didn't think that I stole something at all. She thought that she knew that I had made copies. Somebody probably called and said she's up here making copies of her file. So that's why I think she wanted to look in my purse. So anyway, now you know I have a case in court, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this case has been in court for over... they started in 1991. Recently, the court wanted all the records of all the doctors that I've been to practically since I was born, and I was afraid that she was going to turn in some false records on me. But much to my surprise, she acknowledged that she has no records of me. Now, isn't that interesting? She should have records of me, but she had to say, we don't have any records on this person. Probably because I said, even in the deposition that that they took, that this person was keeping false records of my treatment. Mm. She was keeping a totally false record, and that is, you know, why? Totally false. Not just one thing, not just a report from the hospital, not just the psychological evaluation, but the physical treatment that I was receiving was also false.
So with your lawyers, were you able to show them the photocopies of the documents? Did you still have those at that time?
I still have them, mm-hmm. Yeah. I still have her bills. I still have canceled checks. I mean, she doesn't have the records of me, but I have the records that I got when I went there. And this thing that happened with this doctor is just one of several events that happened with doctors that have left me now afraid to go to the doctor. I haven't gone for my regular... mammograms and things like that since I got out of the hospital. And recently I had a bladder infection, and it bothered me for weeks. And I finally said, okay, I have to go to a doctor, but what will I do? I'm too afraid to go. So I just went into an emergency clinic in a hospital where they didn't know me, where I didn't have an appointment, and where I got treatment. But it's too many doctors have been involved.
Now, were you able to identify, or did you have experiences with doctors that you were later able to identify that were involved in the CIA mind control experiment programs?
Well, what happened is when I told you that I went to the library and I started finding out the names of the different centers and the names of the different people, I realized that many of the centers and people that were involved in my case were actually named in those papers that came out in the 70s and in the church committee hearings.
Mm-hmm.
But still, we don't know absolutely positively that this is CIA mind control because these people were involved in that. I mean, they could have been doing this independently, or it could be somebody else behind it yet, because it seems to me that some of them have been very surprised to discover the things that have happened in my life, linking back further and further. I think that the people, you know how in Nazi Germany everybody claimed that they didn't know what was going on, even the people that lived around the camps, mm. You know, said that they didn't know what was going on. Sometimes people that were in the camps or worked in the camps said that, yes, they knew what was happening to them, but they didn't know what was happening in general. I think that that's what's going on here with this mind control stuff, that nobody really has the whole picture, that different pockets of people are doing different things, and it just got out of hand. And so I wrote a little piece called Bill Ding, and it's about the domino effect. It's like one person is set up to press on another and another and another and another, and finally the whole line goes down. But no one knows anything except who was right behind them and who it was that was in front of them. Mm. And they would be very surprised to see the whole picture. That's what I think.
Well, it seems to be standard operating procedure for intelligence agencies where they compartmentalize the information so that you don't get the big, no one person gets the big picture.
Except the person that it happens to.
Mm. Now, I wonder if you can talk about Dr. Harold Wolf.
Well, Dr. Wolf was one of the people mentioned in the Manchurian Candidate, Search for the Manchurian Candidate.
Mm-hmm.
He was the head of Cornell and the head of the Human Ecology Society at the same time. Now, he wasn't the head of the hospital when I went there, but what he said in that book, the Search for the Manchurian Candidate, was that he that it was important to understand the ways that children are raised and the influences of the culture in mind, and then you can use these influences in mind control. And he said that he would offer the unwitting use of Cornell patients for mind control experiments. And this is, you probably have a copy of the book.
Yeah, that's been documented, and as well the Human Ecology Society's has been well documented as a funding front for the CIA mind control experimentation.
Yes, and so he was head of both of them at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And
again, what was your involvement with him?
Well, I never knew him. I don't even know if he's still alive. But I found, you know, when I was trying to figure out what happened to me, one of the things that helped me understand what happened was this quote from him in John Mark's book, in which Wolf said that he offered the patients of Cornell for brainwashing experiments.
Mm-hmm.
And since that was where I was taken, I figured that it might have a pretty good chance of been
you were in that situation.
The present philosophy of the hospital and the present people running the hospital maybe subscribe to his ideas too.
So he was the director of the Cornell Medical Center before you came
I don't know what years he was there. Mm. But he was quoted in Marx's book, which came out in the late 70s, 79.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been before that he was there, and I don't know how long he stayed there.
Right.
He was not the director when I was there, but I thought that the same policies were in effect apparently.
So
it really helped me understand it. It was like, you know, here I am trying to figure out what happened, and I go to the library and I find that 8 places, including the one that I was kidnapped to, have been mentioned before in connection with mind control experimentation, and it seemed to give me a lot of support that was the reason that all of these things had happened to me.
So you feel that you were involved in the mind control experimentation through the areas of drug experimentation, brain implants. Was hypnosis used with you at all, do you think?
Yes, it was. Hypnosis was used probably beginning in Buffalo, but definitely it did take place in Buffalo, and I was in Buffalo in 19 let's see, I moved there in 1964. And so probably since that time, hypnosis was used on me. I don't think it was used on me before that.
Can you tell us, or do you know how they exactly used hypnosis on you? In terms of what?
Well, there was a psychologist who worked in the school where I worked. And I can remember, this is a very strange thing, and I can remember that he would just sort of look into my eyes, and it felt like this very, very deep connection with him, like somebody that you'd known for your whole life, even though I hadn't known him very long. And I remember walking along beside him one day, and just walking down the hall to lunch or something, and like my arm bumped into him, and it was like electricity went through my whole body. Now that was such a strange thing to me that I never would have told anybody, except that I've been reading the accounts of this in other places where other victims say that this happened to them. I have no way of explaining it, but I know that it happens to people. And it was like at that time I became connected to him in some way that he had unusual influence over me.